Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Griffith Swidler, and I'm the School Partnerships Manager here at the Commonwealth Club World Affairs. We are thrilled to have you all here today, and we have a great day prepared. For those of you who don't know Commonwealth Club World Affairs or have never been here before, we are the oldest and largest nonpartisan public affairs forum in the United States. Every year, we host hundreds of programs with scientists, artists, elected officials, community leaders, and influencers who come to talk about topics ranging from politics to education, climate change to social justice, entertainment, culture, and more. We have lots of options for students and educators, including low-cost memberships and free tickets to most of our programs. Creating Citizens is Commonwealth Club World Affairs' civics education initiative. Building on foundational values of civility, mutual respect, and informed action, Creating Citizens engages young people and adults in meaningful civil dialogue about important contemporary issues. We are grateful to the Corrett Foundation for their generous support of Creating Citizens and their dedication to improving the quality of civics education, both in California and beyond. We're excited to get started. Now, let me introduce you our speakers. We are very lucky to have two strong civic leaders and civics education advocates with us here today. Antonio Lopez is the mayor of East Palo Alto. Prior to becoming mayor, Mayor Lopez served for 3 years on the East Palo Alto City Council. He is the youngest person to have ever served as the mayor of East Palo Alto. Mayor Lopez is also an accomplished writer and poet. His debut poetry collection, Gentification, was awarded the 2019 Levis Prize. Lopez's term as mayor will finish at the end of this year, and he's currently running for the San Mateo County Board of Supervisors. That election will be held in November. Joining the mayor on stage is our moderator, Isabella Romo. Isabella works for the Social Equity Through Education Alliance, an intergenerational organization that works to organize communities and young voters in Florida. She's also a student at UC Berkeley. Isabella, who grew up in Gilroy, will graduate this May, and she'll begin pursuing her master's in public policy this fall at Georgetown University. So please join me in welcoming Mayor Lopez and Isabella Romo to the stage.
Good morning, everyone. As Griff mentioned, I'm Isabella Romo, and I'm a senior at UC Berkeley. And we are joined today by the lovely Mayor Lopez.
What's up, y'all? They're like, come on, what's up? Good morning.
He's excited to see you.
So yeah, I woke up at 7:30 to see y'all. That's how much I love you guys.
Well, Mayor Lopez, let's get right into it. Where are you from? And when did you first become interested in pursuing a career in public service?
Oh, shoot. Well, you know, where I'm from is a very layered question because, well, I'm from East Palo Alto. So I'm from the South Bay, born and raised EPA, California. How many people have heard of East Palo Alto? Raise your hand. Okay. Yeah. And how many people have heard good things about East Palo Alto? Okay. How about bad things? Right. So a little bit of both, a little bit good, a little bit bad. And so I'm from East Palo Alto, born and raised, but my family's from Mexico. So they migrated from Mexico in the 1980s. My dad was a farm worker. He actually, you know, interestingly enough, the whole reason why I'm here is because he was able to get amnesty from the Reagan administration to get a path to citizenship. So just to show you like how federal policy percolates down to people's individual lives, like I'm an example of that. So I'm from East Palo Alto, born and raised, son of Mexican immigrants. Same, my mom from the same town, girl next door, Peter Parker kind of thing, my mom and dad. And yeah, just grew up in the 90s when EPA was in the thick of it, as it were, you know, trying to rise from its ashes of having the notoriety of being the quote unquote murder capita. So it's a majority minority city, BIPOC, working class, and of course, in the heart of Silicon Valley. So many of you are from San Rafael, Oakland High School. You see the issues of gentrification. You see the issues of how expensive it is for families to live there. So, you know, I grew up in that environment where you love your community, you love the culture, and you have a sense of pride for, even though we didn't have as many resources as other cities, because we're next to Palo Alto, we're next to Stanford, we're next to all these big techs. So how do you have a sense of identity in a place that is so obsessed with making money and is obsessed with the new app, right? So I grew up in this sort of environment or crucible, if you will, where people are trying to make ends meet, but also in the meantime, they make community, they break bread. That's the kind of like DNA that I'm cut from.
Well, that's really interesting because a lot of the times, and I'm sure a lot of the students here can relate to this, We are eager to get out of where we grew up. We're eager to go explore new places. But you came right back to East Palo Alto, and now you're nearing the end of your first term or your fourth term as mayor. So what does a mayor do? And what are the responsibilities of the East Palo Alto government?
Yeah, so a mayor, depending on what city you're living, it could be a strong city like in San Francisco and Oakland where they elect the mayor. In small towns like ours in East Palo Alto, it's a rotation. So it's kind of like musical chairs. I got elected to the city council 4 years ago. Then I became mayor last year. So the city council itself appointed me to become mayor. What does a mayor do? The mayor is the face of a city, y'all. The mayor represents what a city's trying to do, everything from environmental justice, from public safety, to education, to improving our roads. So it could be, you know, one of the things I'm doing, for example, right now, and keep it on the DL, one thing, for example, is creating a sister city with the island of Tonga, because we have a very rich Pacific Islander population. And so creating ties with the Pacific Islander community. At the very same time, working with mothers whose sons have been killed over the past few decades, I want to bring together, create an event in the summer to help honor those women who have been holding so much grief. And of course, I also deal this Tuesday, we're looking at the budget, right? So everything from in making sure that our staff is well paid, that the roads are well paved. Last week, I was just in Washington, D.C. We were talking about D.C. earlier, and working with our federal departments to get more money for East Palo Alto, because we have a tremendous issue with water, right? Our infrastructure, right? The pipes and the roads are so old because they've never been renovated, because we've been a low-income city for a long time. And so part of my job is to look at the whole picture. What are the needs? What are the gaps? Affordable housing, tremendous issue, but also is environmental, sea level rise, also is parking, also is water. And so how do you create consensus? How do you get everyone in the room to agree this is what we need to do? Like, y'all ever have families where you guys figure out what you want for dinner, you know, and someone says, oh, I want tacos, or I want American burger, or I want Chinese, right? Okay, now imagine trying to agree on that, not dinner, but a policy with 30,000 people. Right? It's kind of a tough job. And so it's my job to try to bring it together and try to remind people that we're all in the same boat, you know, and I think it's easy in a city like ours to get divisive, particularly as because of the demographic changes over the years, now it's majority Latino, used to be historically Black. Now we have middle class folks coming in from gentrification. So it's a changing city. And so how do you still maintain a sense of identity, a sense of, you know, we're all in this together when there's so many pressures that people are facing? That's part of my job, is to represent that unity. And that's what I'm trying to accomplish in my term as mayor.
Well, that's very admirable. And I'm sure that these students who are either thinking about college or getting ready to go to college would like to hear about your experience getting to this point in your career. It's easy for them to feel pressured or stressed about choosing a college major or even a career long term when you're only a teenager. And so your story is a great example of how there's no linear path to get to where you end up one day. And so what advice would you give to students about finding their interests and entering higher education or a career?
You know, for me, and I want to speak specifically to all you guys, but I also want to address, as a child of immigrants, you know, the pressure is different for me and for our communities, because it's like you not only have to sort of bring yourself up, but your whole family. And they're coming from communities where they want you to be a doctor, or they want you to be a lawyer, or they want you to do something that's going to make that sexy six-figure salary. But at the end of the day, as people who are living in the Bay Area, who are students in the Bay Area, you guys are soaking up ideas, passions, interests that your parents may not have had. And a lot of their push to you is fear. It's fear of how can my kid make a good living? How can they be successful? But you need to also trust your gut. And I'm not trying to say, oh, Antonio, I heard the mayor said to not listen to you. No, that's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that you have to be able to go with what you love, whether it's right. You know, for me, for example, like before being a politician, like I'm a poet. So like when I was in high school, I was coming from a K-8 public school education. That was pretty rough. I went to an affluent private school in the peninsula. And that identity crisis is what prompted me to want to tell my story, right? Because I felt like people didn't understand who I was, where I came from. So what I'm saying to you guys is, it's not a linear path. It's not like I said, oh, I'm going to be a mayor at the age of 29. Like, no, it's about how can I do what I love and take people's perspectives, even if they're my family, but say, I'm going to speak, I'm going to live my truth. I'm going to live my passion. I'm going to live my interest. And you have to trust that that is going to get you far. Like, you have to be able to maintain a sense of belief in oneself. And also, I would say, surround yourself with people who are like-minded. There's that old saying, that old school proverb is, I can tell you who you are by the people you surround yourself with. It's so true. So making sure that if whether it's being an artist or an engineer or being doing robotics or doing dancing, like, be around those same people, those same kids, ask for help, go to the coaches. I mean, the sky truly is the limit for you guys. We live in some of the one of the most beautiful places in the world with so many resources. So please do not be a stranger. Last thing on this note, when I was coming from East Palo Alto, one of the most under, our school was in the bottom 5% of the state of California. We're talking about Department of Education. We had our charter revoked because of low test scores. We had issues of gangs. We had issues of people getting caught up with dumb crimes, right? Teachers would come in left and right. They would leave. Why do I say that? I say that because when I got into this private school, Menlo School, one of the first mentors that I had was a white guy named James Dan. And he told us, the 6-7 of us, people of color kids who were recruited into the school, that shy people starve, right? In other words, ask for help. Be humble enough to say, I don't know something. And I think when it comes to following your dreams, if you don't know how, if you don't know exactly the ingredients, talk to people who do. Talk to folks who know what those steps are to get to where you want to be. And also be open to the possibilities. Like, I truly did not know that I was going to fall in love with public service. And it wasn't until I came back from my master's and on a whim, put my hat in the ring to run for office. And here I am talking to y'all 4 years later. But I had no experience student government, no idea I was going to be in politics, but I trusted my gut. And you have to trust yours too, that what's gnawing inside of you to do something, listen to that, trust it, cultivate it, and let others around you help you kind of fuel that fire. So that's my, sorry I was a little long. That's my little advice.
No, words of advice to take on with them once they're done with high school and go on throughout their lives, right? Don't be afraid to make mistakes. Don't be afraid to try new things, because that's how you fall into things like public service. But these young people in the room, some of them may be too young to vote even. And so why does their voice matter? And what can they do to get involved civically in their communities and engage in public service at such a young age?
So you all know how I won. Like, real talk, like, I'm going to give you the skinny on how I won. So first of all, there were 7 people running in my race, including myself. 3, all incumbents were running for re-election. I had no name recognition. I was this kid at 26 years old coming from college, right? And I won. First of all, anyone want to guess by how many votes I won by? Throw a number. 6? A little higher. 50. 70 votes. I won. You hear what I said? I won by 70 votes. How many people are here? About 100, right? So if half the room decided not to vote for me, I wouldn't be here. Does that make sense? And also, you can say to me, well, Antonio, I couldn't vote at the time, but I didn't finish. The reason I won is because I sat my primos down, my cousins down, and I told them, Adolfo, Isaac, Renee, I said, hey, I want you guys to help me run for office. And they're like, why? And I was like, because it's important. Yeah, well, you know, what's the vice president do? Right? They were kind of what you were saying, like, well, what's in it for me type of thing. And I was like, well, I'll give you guys $30 an hour. And they're like, all right, bet. Sounds good. No, but all jokes aside, when we started knocking on doors, mind you, I was the only person. I just come back from college, right? And I would talk to people from all walks of life. We even walked into a house that was pink and stucco, and it was just Trump, all of it. It was just vote for Trump all in East Palo Alto, which blew my mind. And it was this lovely, like, old white lady just being like, hello, how are you? And we started talking. Right? So all that national identities, all these labels just melted. And it was 2 people talking in her front porch. And you know who helped me win it? The 3, 5, 6, 7 teenagers at your age that knocked on doors with me. Because let me tell you something. When people see young folks organized, it could be a Girl Scouts. It could be about vaping. It could be about creating a pony show in your street. They will listen to you, because it sounds like a freaking cliche, but it's true. You all are the future. Did you hear what I said? You guys are the future. Like, you are the reason people are fighting so hard for climate change, for making sure that this place has businesses. Like, this is your world and your state and your Bay Area. So claim it. And I think that whether you can vote or not, whether by age or immigration status, the fact that you're young and engaged, I cannot stress this enough. Like, look what's happening around in the Middle East right now. And whether you side on whatever part of the spectrum, I'm just seeing the young people speak at city council, speak on school boards, speak on campuses like Berkeley. It's inspiring. And at the end of the day, as a student, when you're going to college, the institutions are built for you. Like, you are the primary customer and the primary person that should be supported. So your voice matters just as much as a trustee or a stockbroker. So what I want to underscore to you guys today is that, one, because you have tremendous superpower as a young person, and two, you're the reason why people are fighting so hard, because you're the future. And so I would say it doesn't matter. This is the kind of work that doesn't require a CV. Like, you don't show up at city council and somebody says, well, tell me where you went to school. No, it's just by showing up and show your beautiful face and being passionate about what you care about. And I'm telling you, I swear to God, like, it may not move all five people in the room, but you're going to get one or two people. And that's where it starts. It starts with the change happens on a local level, person by person. And you are our change makers. You just have to nurture it and believe in it. And so I would say, just go for it. Like, just, you know, what's that Shia LaBeouf? Like, just do it. Like, it's true. You just got to go for it. It's never a perfect time, mm-hmm. but you just got to get involved, you know?
I mean, there's a lot of misconceptions I feel about whether or not youth can get involved in public service at such a young age. But the reality is your guys' voices do matter, and you guys are experiencing the same issues, if not different issues, from the older generations that do regularly show up to give public comment at city council or will help campaigns. But those are the same things that you guys can do. And conveniently enough, one of the main topics of these field trips is civil dialogue and discussion. And so why do you think it's important to talk, work, and engage with people who you disagree with? Do you have examples from your time as mayor where you had to do this?
Yeah, I mean, one, we have to do it because it's the only tool we have. I mean, this is the oldest democracy in the Western world, like the United States. And we can talk about the issues it has of gerrymandering, the Supreme Court, the Electoral College. Like, there are fundamental problems with this system, no question about it. And the fact that it's so expensive for campaign finance, like, there's a litany of a laundry list of reasons why we need to make it better. And yet, this is the vehicle we have. And the part of what makes this country so beautiful, it is one of the only multi-ethnic democracies in the world. Do you understand? Like, if you go to Europe or Scandinavia, their countries are founded upon ethnicities, right? But we're a multicultural fabric. And so we believe in this experiment of, like, people from all across the world and immigrants, right? They come together and make a better life. And how do we all share this space, right? How do we build upon this legacy of, you know, even if we were founded on slavery and all these different racist structures, how can we still create a sense of home, and how can we make it work or make it better? And so how do we do that? We do it through dialogue. Like, we do it by exchanging ideas, about being brave enough to speak to the moment. And so I would say, you know, recently what's happened with Palestine and Israel, like the fact that we have a tremendous community, Jewish American community, that is feeling a sense of fear, a sense of, you know, all this rhetoric, like, how do we feel safe, right, at the wake of the Holocaust? But you also have a Palestinian community that has felt unheard and occupied. And so how do you bridge that gap? How do you tell people that we are here to affirm life? We are here to move the needle forward. How do you break down stereotypes or misconceptions? One issue we have in East Palo Alto is gentrification, right? Someone in public comment, straight up, an older African-American woman said, well, I don't want this place to become Little Saigon, right? In other words, saying that the Asian American community that's coming in somehow does not have as much of a right as Black and brown people do. And so we have to remind each other that we all share this space. We have to remind each other that we're going to disagree. We have to remind each other that it's tough and it's emotional and it's sensitive and it's hard to talk. Like, it is difficult, but we have to lead with love. And we have to, one example I guess I'll share with you is, you know, when we're talking about these resolutions, whether it's for the ceasefire, or whether it's for gentrification, or whether it's for coming together. One example I'll have is, you know, just being able to listen to people in public comment and being able to incorporate their dialogue and say, like, honestly, 9 times out of 10, people are angry at me, are angry at politicians, or angry at so-and-so because they don't feel listened to. So at the end of the day, wherever we fall on the political spectrum, the most fundamental thing is just making people know that you care. And how do you demonstrate care? It's about showing up. It's about being authentic. It's about being vulnerable, putting your cards on the table. I think that's something that for me, I found most successful. It's coming to a room and saying, hey, I don't have all the ideas. I don't have all the solutions, but I'm willing to work with you to figure them out. And I want to exemplify the political courage to speak to a moment, even when it's inconvenient, even when it's difficult, especially when it's difficult. That's what makes this country so amazing, is that we're able to talk through issues. And not everybody agrees with that method, but you have to lead by example. You have to be the example you want to see in the world. You can't wait for grownups to do the right thing. You got to do it yourself. So I would say those recent examples, what's happened in the Middle East, but also this ongoing anxiety about displacement in East Palo Alto. People are afraid of change, whether you're white, whether you're black, whether you're poor. When you're used to something different, it's like, whoa. So how do you broker a sense of your home is still your home and it's just changing? I think that's sort of really the sweet spot that I'm really, as mayor, focusing on in my term.
I really appreciate that, because I feel like we are living in such a polarized society, specifically politically. And yeah, we may have always been politically polarized, but right now it seems like we're more polarized than ever. And so when we're trying to work on such difficult issues like this, the only way to do it is if we're having these difficult conversations with people we may not always agree with. Otherwise, we're never going to get any compromise or any progress towards alleviating the impacts of these issues. And so, building off of my last question, this afternoon the students will be asked to discuss different topics and scenarios related to freedom of speech. So as a poet and writer yourself, why do you think that freedom of speech and freedom of expression are so important?
Because I cannot police what constitutes wrong things to say and right things to say. Like, you know, you look at a historic case like Skokie, which is you had these neo-Nazis, right, burning American flags in a small suburb in Illinois, a Jewish enclave in Illinois. And you know who defended these folks? I mean, these are reprehensible ideas. People who believe in white supremacy, people who believe in against Jews. The ACLU, which was headed by many Jewish American lawyers. So think about that, that there was an era in American history where Jewish lawyers and people who said, yeah, like ideologically, you hate me, but I'm going to represent your right to speak. Think of how beautiful that is. Think about that example of like, you don't think I should be here, but I'm going to give you the right to say what you want because that's your right. And that, to me, the freedom of speech clause is built precisely for tough moments. It's not for the easy cookie cutter stuff, Girl Scout stuff. It's for things that are hard. And no one has I don't have a right to tell you to not speak. No one gets to arbitrate what constitutes the right thing to say. So we have to protect everyone's right to speak, even and especially when those ideas are reprehensible, right? So when a president is coming down and saying these people are rapists and criminals, yeah, it's horrible. And how do you fight back about it? You in the marketplace of ideas and speaking out and saying your piece and proving people wrong. And that's really all it is, ladies and gentlemen. Like that is one of the cornerstones of this country, the ability to speak your mind. And the minute we start to say, well, we can't talk about this issue, or that group can't speak because it's not in our values, we have to, that's a slippery slope, and we have to be consistent with our values. So I think that's the kind of nation and model I want to have, that ACLU model, where we're defending I was speaking to a Palestinian after we passed the resolution yesterday. There was a group of activists that spoke to me and said to me, well, how come you added the October 7th clause? And, you know, it undermines how we feel. And they started talking about the Nakba and the history. And I said to them very gently, like, sister, like, you have to humanize other people, even as other states or governments or forces try to dehumanize you. Does that make sense? Like, you look at the civil rights movement. You look at every single movement in American history. Like, you have to be bigger than the things that are keeping us down. And that, to me, goes back to freedom of speech. Like, you have to work within what we have. You have to be brave enough to speak out, and you have to preserve the right of others to speak out. And I firmly believe that with the right people in place, that's what's going to win at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. And it's really easy when we're so polarized like this to forget that we need to continue humanizing everyone that's involved in these issues and everyone being affected by the issues.
And if I can just follow up, you know what really concerns me too is the fact that, you know, now y'all grew up with the smartphones. You know, I grew up in like that kind of Nokia era where it wasn't that fancy. Like it just plays Snake. Like y'all got it. I don't say good because phones are tough having at like 5, 6, 7 years old. But the point is, you all have an international virtual audience. And so, I don't know how to put this very poetically, it's easy to talk shit over a keyboard, right? It's easy to like be mean to each other virtually. And what I'm worried about sometimes is, as we have these technologies that are evolving, like how does that make it more difficult to show up at the same table and actually have tough conversations, you know? And so I think when it comes to freedom of speech, that's what makes it this question even more complicated, is how do you actually connect? How do you win hearts and minds? How do you connect people? How do you get everybody on the same page? We're not even in the same room. We're not even in the same time zone. We're not even, you know, maybe not even there because it might not be a true account. So these are things that we really got to be mindful of, that we have to monitor. But ultimately, the values are the same. Mm-hmm. It's about being able to speak your mind and protecting the rights of others to speak their mind. And in that marketplace of ideas, the ones that have the most truth, the ones that have the most resonance, will win the day.
Mm-hmm. And I want to come back to how your constituents have been expressing concerns over gentrification. And in East Palo Alto, like much of the Bay Area, it has undergone a huge shift in the last 30 years, like you've been discussing. And a lot has been reported on the drop in violent crime in East Palo Alto specifically. But being in the middle of Silicon Valley, the city's demographics have changed as well. And so how do you feel as mayor about balancing those two things, gentrification and a drop in crime?
Yeah, it's an amazing question. And it's a very pointed talking point because last year we had a historic milestone of having zero homicides in East Palo Alto, zero. And I'm incredibly proud of the work that the churches have done, nonprofits, our police department. It was a village that made this happen. But there were many people on social media that said, well, it's because all the bad people spoke. I mean, I'll be very blunt with you. When I was on the campaign trail, there were even people saying to me, well, it's because a lot of the African Americans left, right? Like blatantly racist things. And, you know, to me, it breaks my heart. And that's when you have to intervene and say, actually, that's not the case. And educating people, you know, making it a teaching moment. And so how do I feel about it? I it's about showing people again that this community, all communities change over time. They evolve. The question is how they evolve and who's part of that change. And so I think one of two things happen with this gentrification conversation. I think there's one group of people who fight back and sort of put their feet in the sand and say, we're not gonna change anything of East Palo Alto, we're gonna fight against gentrification. And then there are folks who leave and they say, you know what, it's too expensive. I'm gonna move to Los Banos, I'm gonna move to Gilroy, I'm gonna move to other areas, I'm gonna sell the house. And in both scenarios, I think there's a flawed way of thinking as opposed to how do you work within the process? Like, this gentrification question is a macro regional issue, right? Like East Palo Alto cannot solve it alone. In the past 10 years, for every unit of housing that was made in the Silicon Valley, in the Bay Area, according to the 2019 San Jose Business Silicon Valley Index magazine, for every one unit of housing, 6 jobs have been made. So it's a basic question of supply and demand. We haven't built enough housing as a region. And so then it puts a pressure on small cities like East Palo Alto. At the same time, as a mayor, I'm looking at our budget. We're looking at the barrel of a $7 million deficit in about 6 to 7 fiscal years. So like, let's say this front row, they want housing for their kids. You're a single dad. You got to worry about your kids. You're a single mother. Low-income families spend 14% of their income on diapers. Two-thirds of my city are renters. A half of those renters are economically challenged, meaning they spend 30% or more on their income on rent. So you have a tenant community that is only there for 4 years, that is low income. You have a city that's facing a deficit. You have a region that doesn't want to build housing. And then you have East Palo Alto. So again, as a mayor, how do I balance these competing forces? How do I let people know that we are continuing to build housing, but we also have a crisis in the horizon that you may not care about? And that's okay, I understand. But it's my job to care about it, because at the end of the day, if we're not looking at the budget, if we're not looking at our fiscal health as a city, no one is. So it's my job to sort of, again, bring it all together. So how do I feel about it? I invite people to speak there, to come to make comment, to tell us what we want, what kind of community benefits we want. You're talking to somebody who didn't have, we did not have a supermarket in East Palo Alto for my childhood. You hear what I said? We didn't have a supermarket. You know what we had to do? Me and my mom, my sister, we had to walk 45 minutes to go to the Lucky Albertsons in Palo Alto, right? The two of the most longest standing institutions in East Palo Alto that have existed are the McDonald's, the two McDonald's we've had, and a mortuary. We as residents deserve to have amenities and we don't, and to have resources, nightlife, a downtown, restaurants. So, you know, on the one hand, issues of displacement are an issue. And I remind people that we incorporated 40 years ago because we wanted to be politically independent and economically independent. And those two go hand in hand. And it's my job to help build the resiliency of a city. And that involves some form of development. So I think my answer to this question is, I think it's about having those complex conversations about how do we build capacity for a city? How do we build a dynamic city that everyone deserves to live in? And how can we stop this crisis of people having to leave East Palo Alto to do everything, to shop, dine, get it, except they just sleep in East Palo Alto. So how do we make a community dynamic? Part of it is development. And there is going to be some gentrification that comes as a result of it. But in many respects, because it's a macro-regional issue, it's inevitable. So it's a bit like climate change, I guess. Like, you can deny it exists. You can try to say, well, it's not going to affect me. But it's happened in the past 30 years already. It's coming. So we have to be a part of that solution. Otherwise, if we don't, we're going to let people with the money, you know, we're going to let the same class that got us here to keep calling the shots. So I think it's a call to action to get people involved and to be part of the sausage making of politics, which is finding that compromise of what's a city that we can all live in that we're proud of.
Yeah, and you've been speaking very eloquently about all these issues going on in your community, but you actually said in an interview that you once lacked the vocabulary to speak out about the issues in your community when you were younger. And so How do you recommend that young people, like the students in this room, go about learning how to advocate for themselves and their community members?
Well, you know, I'm speaking next to an amazing, fantastic moderator who's interned in D.C. and has been involved in government herself. So I think we have examples in this room of just getting involved. Like, guys, like, there's so much. I mean, I'm sure you feel this way. Like, when you got in your job, like, there was so much of it where you're like, I don't know what that means. I don't know what that form is. But you learn and you adapt. And again, being a child of immigrants, all we know is how to adapt. All we know is how to pivot. And so wherever your family's from, wherever you're from, taking that spirit of, like, pivoting, of learning on the go, embracing the adversity, embracing the chaos. I mean, that's kind of hard, maybe not chaos, but embracing the challenge, because that challenge is making you grow. If you're not being challenged on a day-to-day basis, you're not growing, y'all. So I'm not asking you to put yourself through hell and high water, but I am inviting you to reconsider something that may seem daunting. That fear you got, like, I show up to meetings sometimes and I'm just like, I don't know how we're going to get through it. I'm a little nervous. But at the end of it, I'm going to change as a person. I am not the same person 4 years ago. No one is. And part of what's made me change is putting myself in the fire of politics, learning the vocabulary, learning what, you know, an environmental impact report is, learning about what a 501c3 is, learning about how policy is made, a public hearing, you know, a notice of funding. Like, there's so many acronyms that government has. It's nauseating. But that's how things are run in politics. And you have to learn the language of whatever industry you're going to fall in love with. There's going to be parts that you love, parts that you hate. That's just part of the business. And so I would say, you know, if you feel like you lack the vocabulary, you know, don't. I guess it's a bit like having a kid, even though I don't know what that's like, or like getting married, even though I don't know what it's like either. But people tell me there's never a perfect time. You just got to go for it. You just got to go where you're good. So what I'm saying to you is, if there is that, like, thing you want to apply for, or that teacher that's doing that event, or interning in D.C. or going to G-Town, like, you just go for it. You're never going to feel like 100%, I'm ready, I got my suit, I'm ready to go out the door. No, we're human beings. We're worried about things. But if we're not a little bit afraid of something, we're not growing. And we don't let our courage kind of rise to the surface and impress not only the people in the room, but more importantly, impress yourself. And that's how change is made. Change isn't made by voting a resolution or voting a policy. It's about that inner mechanism, that inner machine that changes when you become, when you finally say the right thing or you finally show up. Like that, but you have to change who you are first in the process. And that's the real change. I mean, in my opinion, what do I know?
Well, we've talked a lot about the challenges that you faced in your role as mayor, but I want to know about what challenges you face being the youngest person to ever hold that position. Have you experienced imposter syndrome? And if so, how did you overcome it? Because as these students get ready to enter this new chapter of their lives, it's very easy to experience imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I think you can imagine I'm the youngest person in a lot of the rooms I walk into. And I'm speaking to people who can, no disrespect to anyone, could be my grandparents or my great uncles. But we're at the end of the day, we're equals and we're colleagues. And on a day-to-day basis, you know, there are questions of, well, not as much anymore, but early on into my tenure as council member, I would refer to myself as the young buck, the new kid on the block. There was a sense of, you know, I'm working with colleagues who've done this for 12, 18, 20 years. One colleague has been there since the city was a city, 1983. So he's been there 40 years. He's an encyclopedia of knowledge, Ruben Abrika, and I have great admiration for who he is. But when you have that delta of like someone who's been there since the beginning and you're over here, kind of just got here, there's a sense of like, well, do I have the right to the same space? Should I even be here? Should I even speak? Should I let him speak? So I think part of it is recognizing, and this happens in East Palo Alto a lot, I represent a different generation's way of thinking. Let me give you a local, let me localize it and then I'll expand it. You know, in East Palo Alto, we were a city that had no tax base. We were a former murder capital of the United States. I think there are many people, old heads in my community or elders in my community, who sometimes see East Palo Alto as just a place that's been a victim, as a victim of systemic poverty, of gentrification. And that's true. And I don't take away anything of that. But what I try to remind people is that even in the same breath as we have oppression and systemic inequities, we have amazing people in communities that have always punched above their weight. And it is a disservice to characterize a city as just the former and not the latter. In other words, the very fact that I'm here and the very fact that I tell kids in North Fair Oaks and Redwood City, I ate the same tacos and frijoles and free and reduced lunch as they did. And yet I'm here representing my city. So the notion that we're just a glass ceiling and that we can't have mobility and that we can't punch above our weight is simply ludicrous. And if you look at the history of our young city, there have been amazing individuals, whether in athletics, in arts, in education, that have succeeded and become successful. But the question is, like you said so eloquently, how do we encourage them to come back, to bring their talents and improve the city? So it's not just a small handful of people like myself. And so I would say to people, as far as imposter syndrome, you have an attitude and way of thinking and a way of seeing the world that is fundamentally different than your generation, perhaps your peers. And that is an asset because so much of the thinking that has dominated East Palo Alto has been us versus them, has been a zero-sum game, has been those people want to change our community. And yet we forget we became a city because all other areas in the peninsula were redlined, had blockbusting, had racial restricting covenants, which said that no members of the house will occupy if they're Negro or Oriental, right? This was in our deeds in the 50s in the Silicon Valley. So we were a city literally made because no one else wanted us. And yet here we are telling people you can't be here. Do you see the irony in that historically? With the Asian community, the Japanese that I lived in East Palo Alto in the 20s, who no longer live there because guess what? We interned them as a country in World War II. So what I remind people about our you know, being young is that you have an edge because you see you're at the cutting edge of what's going on in this world. AI, technology, culture, like you're in the thick of like what's going to be the future. And so many of our politicians and people in government lack that. People get comfortable. People get jaded. People become more career driven and they forget why the heck we're even here in the first place. And so I encourage you to just really lean in on your youth, lean in on your energy, lean in on your perspective. Because as I said at the top, imposter syndrome is going to happen and I still deal with it. But think of it as an asset. Think of it as a strength. Think of it as an opportunity to educate the people around you about what perspective and lens they're missing. And that is going to be a tremendous change, game changer in any room you walk into.
Well, similar to experiencing imposter syndrome for a lot of people of color and people from underrepresented communities, working towards social, systemic, or even institutional change can feel like a responsibility. We tend to feel that sense of responsibility to create that change. And that often results in things like burnout, stress, anxiety, and more. And so What has been your experience balancing your dedication to serving your community and with your well-being? Is there anything that you wish you had done differently?
Sleep more. Let me think about that second part, and then I'll get to it. And repeat me the first part again.
Yes. Well, it's easy for us to feel that sense of responsibility, which makes it difficult for us to balance our dedication to serving our communities and our well-being.
Yeah. I mean, so much of it is just about, okay, so this question of burnout. So in addition to being the mayor of East Palo Alto, I'm also a PhD student at Stanford. So in the middle of me coming back from overseas to get my master's, I was starting my PhD at Stanford. That's the whole reason why I came back to the Bay Area, to start my degree at Stanford. And that's when the George Floyd protests happened and my parents were splitting up and I wanted to get out of the house. And I was starting my degree. And so all this confluence of forces kind of came to a crescendo and said, get out of the house and start running. But I'm in a business where I don't really punch out on my job. Like, you know, like being a mayor, like you yourself are the job. Like I am the actual, does that make sense? Like I don't punch out to my positions. Like I'm representing the city 24/7. It's not like, all right, Isabel, you take 5 to 10 and I take 9 to 5 and then we'll switch being mayor. Like, no, like I'm the person of the city. And then my colleagues share that workload. And so it becomes very easy to just not put any guardrails or not put any time and say, I'm open anytime. And I think early on in my career, I just let people talk to me any time of day. And now for my own mental health, it's been important for me to put guardrails, not just for myself, but for my family. Like being in public service is a sacrifice, not just for me, but like my mom, my brother, my siblings. You know, I'm not in the house as often anymore. I have to make time for my loved ones. Like yesterday I saw this film called Monkey Man. It's like the Indian John Wick. It was great. But it was at the theaters with my little brother. We went to the theaters on a Wednesday night because that's the time I have, because this weekend I have to be in Santa Rosa for a Chamber of Commerce conference. So it's like now I have to plan in advance, like those fun dates with my family or with my partner. Like it's like, I think that's what's changed, is I have to be much more insistent upon, sorry, I can't do that. I'd love to be part of your Arbor Day, a tree planting ceremony or fundraiser or gala. And I have to say no more. And that's hard for me because as a child, especially when the people I'm saying no to are the people who look like me, people, you know, it's hard not to have this kind of like crusader hero complex where it's like, I got to save everybody. It's like, no, like you got to also help yourself, and you have to also keep yourself, you know, sustained. And I think that that's part of the thing I'm learning about, is how do I protect my time? How do I, you know, find time for the things that I love and enjoy? How do I stay authentic in all this stuff? Like, it's easy to get lost in the sauce, as it were. But how do I maintain my integrity and remind myself why I did it? Well, it's by connecting with the people that I love and remembering why I did it in the first place. And so I think it's unlearning this sort of like insane work ethic that I saw my dad have as a waiter working for 30 plus years at Sheraton. It's like he had to break his back for us to get fed. And I don't have to have like that constant crazy capitalist hustle all the time. You know, I can also take time to help myself heal. I mean, there's a lot of trauma that I think that I'm still living with as someone who grew up in East Palo Alto. But I think so many of us, and so much of my experience, I've just been running because I didn't want to come to terms with some of the things that I've faced as a kid. And so I think it's so important for your health, for your sanity, for your truth, to just stop every now and then and reflect on how you've changed and give yourself time to grow and give yourself permission to you know, put your feet up a little bit. It's not a weakness. It's a strength. And it's a recognition that you're human too. And I think that part of my own political career or story has been reminding myself that I'm not just an image on a screen or a poster, like I'm a person. And I have to remember that that's part of the change too. So just, you know, don't forget to sleep and don't forget to do things that you enjoy from time to time. I think that's the only advice I'll give on that.
No, definitely. I really resonate with that, especially because we come from cultures, not just as children of immigrants, but as members of American society, where we're taught to just keep working, keep pushing through to get the job done. But the reality is, you know, even as a college student, not as the mayor, but as just a regular college student, you feel that pressure to keep doing more, to keep adding to your plate and making sure you're getting everything you signed up for done. But then you forget to take care of yourself. And that's when saying no comes into play and is so important. You have to be able to draw boundaries and know when you need to take care of yourself. Otherwise, the work that you're doing is probably not going to be as strong as it could be. You're not going to make as much change as you could because you're not taking care of yourself first. And so I appreciate your insights on that especially. But what adversity have you faced as a Latino and son of immigrants in your path in completing a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and now working towards your PhD? How did you overcome this adversity, and what advice do you have for students who are considering entering higher education?
So I don't mean to break your heart here, but actually I remember one of the schools I got into was Georgetown. This was like in December of, I don't know, like whenever I got into college, like 2011 or something like that. So I'm showing my year. And I remember like getting the envelope. I got early action and I told my mom, like, I got into Georgetown, right? Imagine how excited I was. First, my family to go to college. Like, no one knows my family, you know, like kind of that process. And then like my mom straight up, and I'm not, she always says I diss her, but I'm not. It's with love, right? And she says to me, Mijo, what's that? What's Georgetown, right? So it's like, as I move up, whatever that means, the sense of accomplishment becomes more and more legible to my community and to my family, right? Being mayor is more obvious, I think, than most accolades I've had or accomplishments because, you know, they have that in Mexico as well. But I think the higher education space in general is very obscure. It's a black box for a lot of our community. You know, they know that we take classes, but the challenges, the sense of like imposter syndrome, microaggressions, how important it is to make social, make community. I think a lot of my parents' mentality was like, you just go to school, you're not there to make friends, you're there, you know, you're there to just, you know, give it your all. And also just frankly, like coming from communities that higher education wasn't necessarily an expectation. I mean, and again, I'm trying really hard to not try to perpetuate any sense of stereotypes about my culture and my background, but I also just want to be honest about, you know, because of how I grew up in East Palo Alto, like, for many of our family members, like I had neighbors where it's like, as long as my kid's not in a gang or is not a parent at 10 or 18, 19, 20, like I'm happy with whatever I'm happy as long as they're happy. You know, like it's because we're first generation and because we were lower income, we didn't have examples of necessarily people going to these higher spaces. So when you kind of break that glass ceiling, yeah, it's amazing. And Univision and Telemundo will like shout it to the heavens and you got into college. But then what happens when the fanfare stops? What happens when the celebration stops and you're in college? You know, when I went to Duke, and no offense to Georgetown, you know, I loved both, but you know, the pulled pork, I don't know, something about the South got me over, funny enough. And I remember, like, first of all, my college counselor helped pay for my ticket, okay, because we have that relationship and he knew that I didn't have as much money. So I had to take like two flights. I had to take a flight from like SFO to like LAX and LAX to Atlanta, then Atlanta to North Carolina. So I finally get there after like 13, 14 hours by myself. My family didn't come with me. I'm carrying two suitcases. Uber was just happening, so I didn't know what the heck, how to get to campus. I took two buses, got the wrong one, got to campus, went to the wrong side of campus. I went from the greenhouse on West Campus. West Campus to East Campus. And so I'm walking there. My back is sweating. I'm carrying two suitcases. I'm haven't slept. And I remember seeing all these lovely families, right? And it's, you know, a lot of suburban moms, white moms, you know, kissing their kids, saying goodbye with the minivans. And a lot of the workers are African-American, helping pull the furniture into the, you know, I'm just painting you a picture. And it's this beautiful lawn. And all these kids are like getting kissed goodbye. And here I am like by myself, like trying to figure out where's my dorm? Like, where do I had $3,000 that I owed in fees that I couldn't even do laundry the first couple of days. Like I ran out of money like a few months in. And yeah, I mean, part of it was just the sense of being alone, like feeling like I did so well for what? Like I was able to accomplish all these amazing things. Like I came from a school that people didn't expect us to do great things. And here I was getting to this amazing college that I just heard about like 10 months ago and that recruited me basically. And I don't know where to start. And how do I get help? Should I ask for help? Who do I turn to? So I think part of it being Latino is two things. I mean, certainly there were people in high school and sometimes who made comments that were racist or at the very least like kind of nudged at stereotypes. Like people would say to me, oh, you just got in because you're Latino, or oh, like you took the ST2s, you took Spanish. It's easy because you speak Spanish. It's like, well, you had tutors since 5 years old. So, you know, like I just think that there's that. And that's a small minority of people. But most of the struggle was just like you're trying to make sense of a whole new world that no one in your family knows, that no, you have no peer support. And eventually I did find people who were going to help me out with it, but it took time. And I had to get out of my comfort zone. And I eventually joined the frat that was historically Latino, and I got involved on campus and I started to actually advocate, not just for myself, but for other kids, so that when future Latino students never feel that sense of solitude that I felt when I first came into campus. So I think those are the struggles. The struggles are that how do I first believe that I belong here? What tools do I use to belong there? And how do I pay it forward, that three-step process? And that's something that I felt, whether it was at Duke or when I was in New York getting my master's, I went to Oxford for 2 years, and that's a whole nother Hogwarts, Harry Potter world that I can talk about. You know, being from East Palo Alto, I got this big scholarship to study there, and I was rubbing shoulders with Rhodes Scholars, and I mean, just people of a whole different world, and I'm back. And every milestone, I've had to sort of face how I've changed, the environment that I'm in, and fake it till I make it, in other words. I just show at least that I'm confident enough to be present and be part of the conversations. But that's, I've had to really challenge myself, like, because of who I am and where I came from.
Well, I think that's a great note to start our transition to student questions for you. So there is a microphone in the aisle right over here. And if you have questions for Mayor Lopez, please start lining up at the microphone and we will take your questions.
Don't be shy, guys.
My question is, what kind of activities did you do during like high school that got you to this point?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I may not look like it, but I was actually very active in cross country and track. So I surrounded myself with people who were running. And, you know, being a runner, you may not think this intuitively, but there's a good relationship between running and dreaming because you're there. You're like, you're literally just doing this for like 3 hours. What are you going to do? You're going to start daydreaming, at least for me. And I always had that childlike sense of wonder to so much extent. I started to like draft up poems and stories in my head as I was running. And keep in mind, like I was in high school, like when I was, you know, I was one of six kids of color in my grade. I was making sense of this very affluent. I went to Menlo School in Atherton. So like it's this whole kind of environment that's so close, yet so far from me. And so again, how do I kind of make sense of it? Well, I write into the space. And that was through writing. And so I also, in addition to doing running, I was part of local literary clubs. I was part of I also did a little bit of chess. Like I just made myself available to whatever groups that I felt were friendly to me. I would play video games in the computer lab when Halo was a big deal, you know? So I would say just, but more fundamentally, like I let myself be open to opportunities that would help me grow and not necessarily like close them off before they even start. I say, well, what's that going to do for me? Like, no, you got to get into it first. Let it change you. Be part of that sauce. And then you come out of it a different person.
All right, let's hear. All right, so earlier when you were talking, you talked about the deficit that was coming up in the next couple of years. I think it was 7 million. I don't really know.
Yeah, 7 million.
Yeah, memory. So is that concerned you, and kind of has it affected the policy you've tried to implement? And I guess, was there kind of a level of, okay, I'm just the mayor, there are a lot of issues that I wasn't exactly, were there issues you weren't aware of that you kind of didn't really have an idea how to cover?
It's a good question, man. I appreciate it. I mean, I think that when I came into this mayoral term and when I became a council member in general, and even growing up in East Palo Alto, you have this sense of the man, we're here because of racism, we're here because of systemic inequality. Like you have this us versus them mentality, especially growing up next to Palo Alto. Like, dude, like you grow up, you know, seeing that society give you the short end of the stick, that teachers were there for like 3 months and they left, that there were school fights. And here you have a stone's throw away, one of the most affluent districts in the country. You're going to feel some type of frustration of why is it that your community didn't get that? And when I got into government, you start to appreciate the fact that it's a two-way street. and that since 1983, we've had some ability to make decisions to determine our own destiny. Now, you may argue, we don't have as many chances to mess up. We don't have much of a safety net. We don't have much of a cushion. Nevertheless, we've also been part of the problem as much as we've been part of the solution. So I think that's number one. So number two, when you talk about, you know, did I anticipate those issues? I didn't, because I came, you know, I grew up in EPA, having that sense of like, I mean, I need y'all to understand something. Like, I did not have a single white friend when I was in school. Most of the people that I knew were teachers. Most of the kids that I interacted with, like, it was an incredibly segregated area, and it still is. And best believe, like, that informs how you look at people. It took me a long time to unlearn some of that biases. So it answers your question, because when I look at the deficit, it's a reminder that we've also made mistakes, bro. Like, we as a people, as East Palo residents, have made decisions that weren't necessarily in our interest. So when we talk about gentrification, when we talk about the rising cost and values, we also got to talk about the failures for us to buy properties when they were cheaper as a city. We also got to talk about the fact that we've had this area on Bay Road and University that has been vacant for 20 freaking years. There are vacant lots that have been vacant my entire life as a kid, right? And you think that's better than developing it? Like, does a barren plot of land benefit anyone? Does any person benefit from not developing that? No. And so for me, I've learned to embrace the complexity that even in the same breath as we've had an enormous tidal wave of economic pressures, of political pressures that have stacked the odds against us, we also have agency as a people. We also have the ability to push back and to also be part of the solution. And historically, we have not. And in some cases, we haven't. And I think that's sort of the nuance. That's the arc that I've really embraced and learned to articulate in these past 4 years.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Being such a young mayor, like at your age, do you feel as though people ever dismiss you or your ideas because of your age?
My girlfriend's in the audience. She's going to laugh. Yes and no. Yes, because I'm young, but no, because I'm young. So it kind of goes back to what I'm saying about, some people will say to you, like, even when I ran, like, you're too green, you're too young, you're too inexperienced. And people will always give you that excuse, bro. You're too young, you're too old, you're too woman, you're too queer, you're too fat, you have too many tattoos, you're too Indian, your hair is too big, your hair is too red, your shirt's too green. People will just make all these excuses. But you know what happens? You prove them wrong. And suddenly the criteria changes. And suddenly someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez can be, go from a bartender to be our congresswoman. Someone from Maxwell Frost can be a first Gen Z congress member at 27 years old. So it's like our historic, or it's like civil rights movement. You just got to break that psychological barrier. And I think, I had a resident, Ms. Jen Steffens, African-American woman, has been in the community for as long as I know. Her family has been part of the community. Again, the black community has been part of of East Palo Alto since the 50s, even earlier. And she told me, and I'm not trying to gas myself up, but we're sitting at her dining room table, and she looks at me and says, Antonio, I think you've made more change in your 4 years than I've seen in a long time as an elected. And I think part of the change, honestly, isn't just the policy making. It's breaking that us versus them mentality of, like, somehow I win and you lose and I win, because I'm a product of both the East Palo Alto community, but also all these other spaces that have informed. Like, I don't look at things as zero-sum game. I also don't look at, like, gentrification versus preservation. These things are complicated, and you have to work within the messiness of them. And so I think by being young, I demonstrate to people, yeah, I don't have the same perspective as you do, but I also, and this being very, I'm not trying to flex here, but I bring the future with me, and so do you. And people are going to have to appreciate that, liking it or not, because I'm not going anywhere, and nor is the groundswell of activists and young people and youth that I want to have a seat at the table. And so I think, you know, it's biblical. It's the classic push and pull. There's an older guard that is going to want to keep things the way they are, and then a newer generation is going to say, actually, we want things to change a little bit. You know, I want to be able to take my girl on a date in East Palo Alto and not have to go to Palo Alto all the time. Is that too much to ask? I don't want to keep eating Swedish meatballs at IKEA. No, I'm serious. I don't want to go to the same Three Brothers again. Oh, what do we have? Tacos. Oh, that was very creative, you know? I want something different. We live in the California, man. We got all this amazing cuisine. So I think it's just insisting that we deserve better and that you can't just argue the same, I'm an outsider. No, I grew up here, bro. I went to school down the street. I'm East Palo Alto just as you are. And I think it's that example that's going to make the change.
As the mayor, how do you balance, like, doing poetry and having to say no to activities?
Yeah, it's a great question. I like that. What's your name, bro?
Vincent.
Thank you, Chinta. Thank you, Vincent. I appreciate you. You know, I forget I'm a poet sometimes. But you know what I remember? Because poetry, at the end of the day, what separates a poem from a song or from an article, from a political track, from a manifesto, poetry is an emotional object. It has to move you, right? But remember what I said earlier? You can't make a change unless you move yourself first. There have been times in my tenure as council member, dude, I've been to funerals. Like, I've had to see mothers bury their sons, man. I've had to help people move their belongings from cars that have been totaled because of floods. I've had to console. I mean, and that traumatizes you. Like, it's hard for that not to stay with you. It's hard for things not to get personal. So how do I stay sane? How do I remind myself that I'm human too? Poetry. So a lot of my poems that have been written in these past 4 years, it's not that I've like woken up and said, I'm going to write 9 to 10. It's there have been moments in these past 4 years that have forced me to come to the desk and figure out how I feel about this. There was a shooting in Half Moon Bay last year where 7 farm workers were killed, 5 Asian American, 2 Hispanic. And I was part of the delegation that went to Oaxaca, Mexico to bury Marciano, one of the farm workers. And the family asked me to help me bury this man that I did not even know. But his family at the altar, I should say, asked me if I could be part of the burial process. So like, imagine just how emotionally intense that feels. Crying for like 4 hours and realizing I'm not even crying about this brother. I'm crying about the fact that people can't mourn. I'm crying about COVID. I'm crying about growing up. I'm crying about the fact that his sister has to be FaceTimed because she can't go to Mexico because she's undocumented. My tia, when my grandmother passed last year, we were trying to get a humanitarian visa for like 6-8 months, paid $400. They didn't even give it to her, right, when my grandfather died. So like, I'm trying to remember your question. Like this, the enormous injustice, things are just wrong, dude. Like, I don't know what else. Things are just wrong in this country. Like, just blatantly wrong. And as a poet, your whole job is to create this thing that can wake people up and like get people emotionally aware and remember that we're human beings and what we're seeing, even as we're used to gun violence or used to sexual assaults on campus or used to people in poverty, like it is still wrong and you still have to have some emotional connection to it and you have to be uncomfortable with it. And so like, you know, for me, there have been moments and episodes in my career that have forced me to address that for myself. And hopefully that is a vessel or a vehicle or a way in which other people, regardless of their race or background, can feel part of the solution. And that's the beauty of, you know, I have a book of poetry and people ask me, what's the book about? And I try not to tell them that it's about a first generation Latino immigrant. It's about you. It's about being an American. This book is for you. And I think that's at the end of the day where I'm coming from. It's like, yeah, I represent a small hood in like the heart of Silicon Valley, but many of the issues that we're addressing, education, inequality, you know, these are issues that the entire country is facing. And so it's just using a poem as an invitation for people to become part of the conversation when they feel that maybe by zip code or by race or by gender or whatever, they may not feel like it's their thing to talk about. Does that make sense? Thank you, Vincent.
And thank you for your song.
Yes, sir.
Hello, my name is Jamali. And I guess, yeah, my question for you today is, what would you say is like the toughest thing you face as being mayor?
Well, I'm still in it, so you gotta talk to me in like 8 months when I finish it. But, well, I mean, I think a lot of it is just time management. You know, there's so many things that I want to support. There's so many things that I want to do. Like, for example, you know, I was just thinking about it this morning. We had one of the first, one of the first Afrocentric community colleges in the country called Nairobi College, and I want to work to make it a historical landmark in East Palo Alto. And I think part of the hardest part is like, as I want to endeavor to do these projects, like think about my legacy as someone who wants to bring solidarity and bring people together, also recognizing that kind of to the previous brother's question, the gentleman with the, I think it's you, man. Yeah. You're asking, or somebody was asking about the deficit, right? And at the end of the day, it's like, I got to learn how to say no to people too. Even in things that I care about, even in things like, you know, again, going back to the African-American community, you know, there's a woman who showed up to every city council and all her comment is, we're still here and you can't forget about us and we're the reason this city was built. And I, to a tremendous extent, agree with her. And I also think that part of our job as the city is gentrifying is preserving that history and letting people know who come into this community that you should learn about East Palo Alto, the struggle that we did, the fact that we were unincorporated, that we had a landfill for 30 years that the county put in our city, right? Because we didn't have political power. And so reminding them who were the groups that took the lion's share of activism to make a difference. I think the hardest part of my job is to like letting people know that I'm not just here for one group or another group. I'm here for the city. You know, people, when I got elected, it was one of the first times that we became a majority Latino council. And I think a lot of people in the community, just by virtue of me being Latino, had a sense of maybe I wasn't going to advocate for them. Maybe I wasn't going to be their leader. And I think it's my job as a young person to say, as someone who grew up in East Palo Alto, I'm for everybody who grew up in the soil. And I'm going to govern and advocate in a way that shows that. And not in a kumbaya way, because we have problems, there's tensions. But to lead by example and to put in place those policies or ideas that are going to demonstrate that we all are part of this land. So going back to the Tongan Sister City Initiative, going back to this historical landmark for some of our historically Black colleges or some of our historically Black institutions that help build the city, I think that's tremendously important. Even as our community becomes more brown or more, I don't know, whatever Facebook and tech is going to kind of impinge on us, but I think it's about showing people that I really am about bringing balance to the community and about just, I'm honestly just trying to break this whole stereotype of outsider and insider, of gentrifier and native resident. It's like, what's a native resident? Unless you're a loney, you're not native, respectfully. Like, my family's been here since 1952. Great. And homeboy got here last week or 10 years ago. Does that mean your voice is somehow more important? That's not how this works. Like, we don't take percentages of votes where your vote's 80% because you grew up here longer than. No, we have to be brave enough to actually live in the world we want to see. And it's hard. So I'm trying to just exemplify that.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Well, while we transition to the next question, I also want to go back to what you said previously about how you use poetry in the mix of your work with public service, with education. And I'm curious to hear about how you use it as a form of resiliency, because at least as a researcher, previously researcher at the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley, we learned a lot about resiliency training. You know, we're seeing all of these traumatic events unfold right in front of us, that it can take a toll on us when we're consuming so much media of these events. So do you feel like you've ever used poetry to practice resiliency in your work and make sure that you're taking care of your well-being while seeing all of these crazy issues right in front of you?
Yeah. I mean, I need poetry the same way a flower needs water, you know, and I think that, and I'm just speaking as a young Latino man, you know, just if I may for a moment, I think so much of our survival as a community has been to not lean in on the hurt, because East Palo Alto has been just a series of griefs, public griefs, private griefs, losing loved ones, losing homes. I think many of our residents are haunted by some of the things they've experienced. And we're a young city. And because there's been such a quick succession of devastating things that happened, I mean, like April 27th in my calendar, I'm going to be starting that day doing a training. And then at 4 o'clock, I'm going to be presenting a proclamation to a mother who lost her son because he had a heart attack. And he's a college student, and he wasn't gunned down by gun violence, so it's a different reason. But nevertheless, she lost her baby. And then I'll be going to a person's birthday party. And then, so it's like, I'll give you another one. Juneteenth, 2022. So this was like late June. There were two homicides that happened in the span of about 3 weeks. One was a 34-year-old black man named Ralph Fields, who was gunned down at 6 p.m. at a park in broad daylight. And the video went viral of young girls, like, in the shaky cell phone screaming, "Mom," like, there's these gunshots, right? This is 2022. 3 weeks later, a young 15-year-old kid gets shot and killed in front of his mom's house in the apartment. I donate a pretty good amount. I donate some money for the GoFundMe, right? And that same, and so then the family invited me to kind of like a quesabirria, like potluck, to commemorate his, you know, celebrate his life or whatever life a 15-year-old can have. And that day was a Juneteenth. So we have this place called the Four Seasons. It's like the area that's like the most that's developed, and we developed it, and we knocked down a lot of our black and brown businesses because we needed the money as a city, right? And so I walked from the Four Seasons Juneteenth celebration, literally like 5-minute walk, to the back of those that hotel where the West Side's at. The West Side is a part of the city. The city is divided by 101 freeway, the US 101. That's where most of our housing is, so multifamily housing. So it's very dense, very packed. And in this narrow courtyard, there's like an altar of all these candles and these women lighting it up. And there's these guys burning donuts and these girls drinking shots of Bocanas and this couple that's fighting for some because his baby mama, like all this chaos, right? And here I am, and here's the mother kind of, you know, looking sullen. And the senator comes in. He's my boss. He's paying his respects. He doesn't speak Spanish. Mom doesn't speak English, so I decided to translate for him. So she translates to him in lifetime how her son got shot and killed, play by play, and I'm hearing this for the first time. And so I'm translating it even as that grief is passing through me. Does that make sense? So it's like I'm hearing how he's getting killed for the first time, telling my boss, and then I'm telling I'm telling her what she's saying about his condolences, and I'm over here like I just presented a presentation celebrating the liberation of black people from slavery 200 years ago. Does that make sense? Like, you know, how do I use poetry? Like, poetry forces me to slow down. Like, poetry forces me to say, like, yo, like, this stuff is, like, this stuff hurts. Like, this stuff is painful. Like, this stuff is devastating. And it still hits me. Like, I still think about it, and I start to really get emotional about it because, like, that's why we're here, you know? I mean, so yeah, poetry allows me to like stay rooted, you know? And it's not all bad stuff. Like, I want to emphasize that, like, it's not all grief, but you can't heal what you don't reveal, you know? Like, that's, and for me, so much of my life has been just refusing to slow down. And so poetry just is that outlet. It's that pressure valve to just exhale a lot of those things that have been pent up that I've conveniently buried for a lot of my life. And so much of my success, I'll be very blunt with you, previous to this moment, I just turned 30, right? So much of my 20s has been about like running and burying what bothers me. And that's just not a sustainable model. And I invite you all to think about with me how you can acknowledge devastating things that happen in your life and also move forward and let those things inform you and invite people to have that conversation. But also don't be afraid to address how it's hurting you. I think it's just the vulnerability thing. Mm-hmm. And leading, having leadership that's able to be vulnerable, I think is so important too. We're not just strong men in suits or strong women in suits. Like, we're feeling these things just as anyone else is. And so I think poetry at bottom allows me to be authentic and be genuine. I cannot be anyone else but who I am and the things that have made me, for better and for worse. And so it's those moments that I turn to humble me, even as I'm experiencing all these amazing things or bad things in my life. I'm like, this is where we started as a community, and this is where we still are, and there's still tremendous work to be done, and I'm part of that.
Well, I think I speak on behalf of all of us. Thank you for your authenticity and sharing these difficult stories.
Can I ask my question?
Of course. Yes, I was about to direct it to you. Would you like to ask your question?
Sorry, I'm a teacher at Oakland High School. Shout out to Vincent and
Jamal. Hey, teacher.
Coming up to
ask. Give a round of applause for our teachers, y'all.
Oh, don't. So I just wanted to, so first of all, like, I love your story. It's an incredible story, inspirational. So thanks for coming and talking and sharing about that. I had a question. You kind of touched on this a little bit, just from like a lot of us coming from communities that are like distrustful of like government, politicians. And then now you like being a mayor, like you're the man, you know, you're part of the establishment. So I'm just wondering, like, do you feel like that's a conflict, first of all? And then, like, just how do you keep trust in the community? Like, when you have to make those hard decisions and say no, some people get the money, some people
don't.
That's
right.
Like, how do you handle that?
Yeah, I think that's, like, I appreciate your question. And it's true, like, you know, my girlfriend and I have a mutual buddy of mine, right? And I met this brother at Stanford, and he's a good dude. But, you know, this is the Zoom world, mind you. And we're both Latino, and we're both in the space. And he knew I was a council member. And he's like, I'm not going to lie, bro. When I first met you, I thought you were just some sleazy politician. I'm like, how? Like, I'm on Zoom. Like, I'm in class. Like, what part of me looks sleazy or politician? But you're right. Like, I was joking around with the group backstage that, like, being an elected official is kind of like dating somebody who's been in a series of really, really, really bad relationships. And so there's all this baggage where it's like, I don't trust you. You guys always say this. I'm like, who's the guys? Like, who else is here? Like, who are these people? You know? But you're right. Like, we come from communities that are distrustful of government, that don't trust their politicians. And why should they? Like, to keep it a full bean. Like, there are things, by the way, is that a saying, full bean, or did I just make that up? To keep it a bean? Does no one else say this? All right, maybe my girl's right. It's not I don't know where I heard it from. But to keep it a bean, like, keep it 100, like, yeah, people have every reason to be distressed their government. I mean, I got elected during COVID, okay? That's the other thing I have to remind myself. There's so much. I got elected in December of 2020, right? So the government was just distributing vaccines. And in the middle of a pandemic, I had no political experience. I got to figure out how to get life-saving vaccinations to my community in a community that doesn't trust government sometimes, right? So this the history of vaccinations towards African Americans, the Tuskegee Institute, Latinos, in terms of, like, there's all these WhatsApp. There was so much misinformation. And so I got my first taste of that question when, you know, how do I handle it? Well, first of all, it's about having connectors, people who speak the language of the community, both figuratively and literally. So we had people at work with Stanford, doctors doing Zoom sessions, debunking all these stereotypes. I mean, I'm telling you, people had videos of, like, saying, oh, there's microchips in the vaccines, you know, or the government. I mean, it sounds funny, but, like, people believe that. Or, you know, there's issues of heart pressures or all that stuff. And then most recently with gentrification, I remember, like, when I got elected, like, some people said, oh, he's in the pocket of developers, or he's this, he's that. People are going to put all these narratives about you, and you're not going to be able to shake them off, maybe, perhaps. But that's why it makes it so much more important for you to lead by example and being able to have those conversations with people and saying, hey, like, it's not that I want to gentrify my community. It's that we have this enormous delta of economic loss, and reminding people, like, that a city not just houses people. It should have dynamic parks. It should have an economic center. It should have roads. And don't we want sidewalks? Don't we want water that is clean? And to do that, that requires putting in money. So I think I think a lot of it is just about, like, getting the right people in the room. I think it's also about being brave enough to keep showing up to the meetings and again, just being the example. I can't stress that enough. Like, a lot of this stuff isn't articulated. It's just you doing the thing and showing people, okay, maybe we can bring this community together. Maybe we can develop, but also not lose people. How do we come with a solution? Because activists and people who are going to be in the meetings, it's an ecosystem. It's people's job to advocate for something specific. That's what makes this system awesome, but it's your job to bring it together. So I think part of the thing that I've learned to appreciate is that even when someone's coming at me edgewise and, like, shouting at me, it's not personal. It really isn't. It's about a systemic failure of addressing needs and their perception that you're feeding into that machine, even as you know that you're not, that that's not what you're there. And it's just about being patient and being loving and meeting people where they're at and keep biting at the apple and getting it right and getting it right and figuring out what the benefits are, housing or getting it right, but showing up again and again and again. And eventually, we do get progress. We do make change. We do make the sausage, but we can't get personal. We can't be petty. We can't be divisive. We have to remember people are passionate because they love their community, and we just have different perspectives about how that goes about.
Well, what really stuck with me about what you said is that you need to speak the language of the community, because that's why representation is so important at all levels of government. You know, we often overlook local government as critical to the change that we want to see in our immediate communities. But in reality, being involved in local government, speaking for yourself, but also the communities that you represent, is so important, because you need to be able to speak the language of the communities to actively work with them. So we're closing in on our time with Mayor Lopez. A few last words before we wrap up. Thank you so much, everyone, for your wonderful participation. For those of you watching online, please check out the Creating Citizens webpage for more information about student and educator civics education projects. And before we sign off, let's please give East Palo Alto Mayor Antonio Lopez one more big round of applause. Thank you, everyone.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.